name is Barbara Rossing. I'm a New Testament doctoral student at Harvard Divinity School. And this week we're going to have a little mini-series on lifestyle in Luke, especially looking at meal themes today and Friday, and then tomorrow looking at the Christmas story and some of the lifestyle issues that that raises for us. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Gracious God, we give thanks for this new day. We pray that you will open your word to us today to understand your purpose in our lives, to read with joy the gospel that you give to us, and to listen to one another and to the word of your Son, Jesus. Amen. Okay, today what I want to do is set the context of this whole meal theme in the Gospel of Luke. I ordered for the bookstore this book by Robert Karras called Luke, Artist and Theologian. And in it, what he's doing, his subtitle is Luke's Passion Account, but what he does in the first chapter, he doesn't get to the Passion Account until the last chapter, and what he does before that is look at the question of why Jesus was crucified. And his thesis is pretty interesting, I think, so I just want to read it to you. In one sentence, here it is. My major point is that in Luke's gospel, Jesus got himself crucified by the way he ate. What do you think about that? By the way he ate. Anyway, he develops the thesis that actually the more I think about it, the more I like it, and it certainly is provocative for our discussion here at Holden, is that Luke's gospel, more than any of the others, structures Jesus' most important teaching, his most important parables, his most important encounters with people around mealtime themes. That if you compare Luke, for example, with Mark or Matthew, teaching that happens in the other gospels in other situations could be as they're going down the road, or when they're on a mountain, or in a house, or something like that. Luke has taken the same material, parables, or teachings about how to behave or whatever, and put it in a meal setting. And it's almost as if deliberately, Luke wants to communicate a Jesus who is constantly eating and drinking with people. And let me just read another quote from Karras here, because I think it's really interesting. There is considerable truth in what is said about Luke's gospel. Jesus is either going to a meal, at a meal, or coming from a meal. The extent of Luke's use of the theme of food is appreciated only when the reader realizes that the aroma of food issues forth from each and every chapter of Luke's gospel. Well, it may be a slight overstatement there, but we can look at some of that this week and see what you think about that whole theme of food in Luke's gospel. Anyway, let's just walk through what the major meals are, and then we'll also look at some of the themes. Well, why don't I start actually with the whole controversy, the question of, is Jesus crucified in Luke's gospel for the way he eats? Karras makes the case on the basis of some of the accusations that emerge almost immediately about Jesus. If you look at chapter 5, for example, and this is the one we'll go back to later and specifically study, but already in chapter 5, the scene is set. In verse 30, okay, he's going to call Levi. That's going to be our text for today, Luke 5. Does everybody have a Bible? Okay, there are some on that shelf over there. There's a bunch up here. You do need a Bible for today. Chapter 5, verse 30. The Pharisees see that he calls Levi to be his disciple and that he eats with him. And right away it says, the Pharisees and their scribes were complaining to his disciples, saying, why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners? So already he's causing scandal here in chapter 5 by the way he eats. And then you go on and look at verse 33. They're going to hit him again with another accusation. John's disciples, like the disciples of the Pharisees, frequently fast and pray, but your disciples eat and drink. Well, that's quite a contrast there, isn't it? Between, you know, seemingly religious behavior, fasting, and praying. You know, we all think praying is good anyway, even if we don't fast too much anymore. Probably should think about that a little bit too. But anyway, John's disciples fast and pray, and yours eat and drink. So early on, Jesus gets the reputation, anyway, as do his disciples, of being big eaters, big drinkers. And this is further developed in chapter 7, if you want to look at verses 31 to 34 here in chapter 7. Well, actually, let's just pick it up with 33. This is another controversy with the Pharisees. Jesus is answering some of their accusations. Okay, he says, "For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say he has a demon. But the Son of Man has come eating and drinking." So already now Jesus is picking up on that same thing as his self-designation. "The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, 'Look, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.'" So it's not just, you know, normal amounts of eating and drinking either. When you get the reputation of a glutton and a drunkard for excess, right? For large quantities of food consumption and beverage consumption. And so he's saying, you know, "You're calling me a glutton and a drunkard." And he's not really answering that, right? I mean, he's just saying, "Look, this is what you're calling me." And compared to John's disciples. Anyway, so in Luke, this does seem to be a theme that is early on developed about Jesus. Now, the accusation, glutton and a drunkard, it doesn't just have sort of excessive behavior connotations. It's also a great sinner. And this, in fact, is someone that they're told to put to death in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy. And let's look briefly at that passage in Deuteronomy 21. It's kind of shocking, actually, how bad this is. You know, it doesn't just mean being overweight or, you know, eating excessively, but it's far worse than that. Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 to 21. If somebody would read, or actually, what page is it on in these black Bibles? Whoever finds it first.
170.
Okay, Deuteronomy 21, 18 to 21. Will somebody read that for us?
"He has a stubborn and rebellious son. He will not obey the voice of his father and the voice of his mother, and though they chastise him, will not give heed to them. Then his father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city at the gate of the place where he lives. And they shall say to the elders of his city, 'This, our son, is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard.' Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones, so that you shall purge the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear and fear."
Pretty serious, right? It's almost like there's a ritual sort of pronouncement. If you've got a kid that won't obey you, you know, then you've tried everything, then you take him out and you call him a glutton and a drunkard. So these two words are the specific label that is given to pretty serious rebelliousness. And the way that Israel, at least in this passage, prescribes to deal with that, although in a course I had last semester, we were looking at some of the ways the rabbis interpreted it, and it's pretty clear that this was never put into effect. They had so many kind of contingencies, I mean, because it is a pretty awful punishment. But anyway, this is almost a ritual phrase then for disobedience and serious rebelliousness, is to call someone a glutton and a drunkard. And the punishment was stoning. So you can think of this almost as one of Jesus' first passion predictions here, where he says, "You call the Son of Man a glutton and a drunkard." And he knows the consequences that has for a person to get that label, that it means that person is to be put to death, even if it wasn't actually implemented. Finally, let's look at chapter 15, verses 1 and 2.
In Luke?
Yeah, Luke 15, 1 and 2. Sorry. This comes after a whole chapter that is probably the most important meal scene in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14. Does somebody want to read these verses?
Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them."
Okay, so again, the accusation against Jesus is building up throughout the gospel. Continual scandal that starts already in chapter 5 about who Jesus eats with, and also how much he eats and drinks, too, those two themes. I've put on the board here sort of a walk through the gospel looking at the different meal scenes. And these two... Oh, wait, I didn't even put in chapter 19. Well, anyway, the gospel, the first meal that Jesus has, a major one, is the call of Levi in chapter 5, and that's what we'll come back to. And then also, after these meals with Pharisees, let's see, it'd be right in here, is another major event with a tax collector, the last one before he's crucified, and that's the call of Zacchaeus. You know, where Zacchaeus is short but very evil tax collector, the leader of the tax collectors, is converted by Jesus, and Jesus says, "I must stay at your house today," Zacchaeus, presumably to have a meal with him. So those two are the brackets then around all these other meals in the gospel. Probably most significant, at least in terms of their uniqueness to Luke, are these three meals with Pharisees that are unparalleled in any of the other gospels, where Luke takes major teaching that happens in the other gospels and other places and puts it in a context of a meal with Pharisees. The first one is with Simon the Pharisee. Why don't we just look briefly at these? We can walk through it here. Luke 7. Typically, how these three meals with Pharisees go is you think, oh, they're going to sit down at a table together, but there's always some interruption. Some unwelcome visitor comes in two of them, the first and the third. And the second one, it's that Jesus fails to wash his hands, and so that generates controversy. But there's the meal never goes smoothly. There's always an interruption or a disaster that happens. And then Jesus uses that event to start his teaching that takes place in this meal context. So in this one, one of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And a woman in the city who was a sinner, having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. And we know the story. How she takes this ointment. In this case, she washes his feet with it. Anoints his feet, not his head like in Mark and John. She anoints his feet and wipes his feet with her hair and causes basically an interruption, a big interruption to this meal. Simon the Pharisee is scandalized because he thinks Jesus should know who this is and what sort of woman she is. And then that is the occasion for Jesus' teaching about forgiveness. And, you know, where he tells a parable about who is the more forgiven, kind of, or who is the more happy over being forgiven. So that's the first meal with Pharisees. Then the second one is in chapter 11. Let's look at that. Does somebody want to read this? 37 to 41 here.
While he was speaking, a Pharisee invited him to dine with him. So he went in and took his place at the table. The Pharisee was amazed to see that he did not first wash before dinner. Then the Lord said to him, "Now you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You fool! Did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? So give for alms those things that are within, and see, everything will be clean for you."
And then it continues beyond that too. I mean, there's a lot more teaching that takes place at that meal through the end of the chapter. Okay, we skipped over Luke's account of the feeding of the 5,000. I'll talk about that on Friday. What I want to do today is look at a couple meals where Jesus is guest at somebody else's house. Levi and Zacchaeus, and we'll also briefly talk about these Pharisees ones too. And then on Friday, I titled that one Jesus as a Waitry, because that's what we call the service here at Holden. But anyway, where he himself is the host and the server, and that would be the feeding of the 5,000, and then the Last Supper, which is probably the most important meal in the Gospel of Luke. So we'll look at those together. But anyway, that was in chapter 10, I think, but I don't see it here. Well, anyway, skip over that one. Okay, the next meal with the Pharisees is chapter 14. In fact, this is probably the most important meal with the Pharisees here, all of chapter 14. This is his third meal now with Pharisees. And this time, you can see on one occasion when Jesus was going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on the Sabbath. So it's the head of the Pharisees and it's the Sabbath. It's a very, very important meal scene here. And the interruption in this case is a man with dropsy, which is like edema. It's water retention, kind of a sickness like that. And Jesus heals him on the Sabbath in front of all these people at this meal. And then that occasions a great deal of controversy. And then Jesus tells all these wonderful parables about meals, some of which we find in the other Gospels, some of which we don't. But Luke has placed them all in the context of this meal with the leader of the Pharisees, about who to invite to the banquet. Is the first one. When you give a banquet, don't just invite your buddies and people who can repay you, but invite the poor and the maimed and the lame and the blind. It tells them that. And then another parable about when people don't come to your banquet, the people who have been invited, then what you should do and all this. So it's a really important meal scene that then generates these parables also about meals. Well, I skipped over the Mary and Martha story, too. But anyway, there's a lot of different mealtime scenes in the Gospel of Luke. Finally, the call of Zacchaeus in chapter 19, which is the last meal with someone before the Passion story begins, where he says to Zacchaeus, "I must dine at your house." He actually says, "I must stay at your house" in verse 5. So we're not told it's actually a meal, but it probably was. And then we go to the Last Supper in chapter 22, and we'll look at that on Friday. But this is a big meal scene with a lot more teaching than in the other Gospels. In Mark and Matthew, the Last Supper is certainly a very powerful event, but in Luke, it occasions all this teaching that we'll look at on Friday, so it's more of kind of a teaching moment as well. And then Jesus is crucified. And then if you look at the resurrection stories in chapter 24, verses 30 and 31, somehow the disciples with whom Jesus has walked on the Emmaus Road have not recognized them, have not recognized him. He has walked and talked with them, and yet they don't know who he is. And it's not until he breaks bread with them in verse 30 that finally their eyes are open and they recognize him. So there's something about eating. If Jesus had a special style of breaking bread, if it was the very act of eating with them that recalled who he was or whatever, we don't know what it is. But anyway, you read in 30 and 31, when he was at table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Their eyes were opened and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. So anyway, again, it's eating that occasions their recognition of him as their risen Lord standing in their midst. Let's just look at a couple passages in Acts as well, because as you know, probably Acts is kind of part two of Luke's gospel. Like Acts 2, 44 to 47. Put these up there too.
I think it is important to see the continuation here.
Does somebody want to read this one? You know these two books are a sequel because they're both written to Theophilus. And then in the book of Acts, the author says, "In my first book, O Theophilus, I laid out for you," and then tells what he laid out. "Now in my second book, I'm going to continue with these same themes." So anyway, you look at Luke and Acts as part one and part two of the same account. Does somebody want to read this one for us?
"And all who believed were together and had all things in common, and they sold their possessions and goods and distributed them to all as any had need.
and day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they partook of food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to their number day by day those who were being saved.
So anyway, in these accounts of the earliest Christian community, food is always right at the very center of their life together. In this case, they owned their possessions in common, so it seemed like they were having communal meals frequently. In the epistles too, in 1 Corinthians, we read about how the Christian community would meet to eat together. So that as they, you know, thought together, how should we live out the faith that Jesus taught us? How should we continue his ministry in our midst? Table fellowship with one another was a really important aspect of that, of how they understood Jesus. And they put meals right at the center of their life together. Then look at chapter 10, 10 and 11. This is the whole story that tells about how Peter came to realize that Gentiles also were welcome in the Christian community. And you know this story, right? That Peter didn't want to go to Cornelius' house, even though he was told to do so. And but then he has this vision, you know, of this sheet coming down from heaven here in chapter 10, verses 10 and following. He became hungry, wanted something to eat. And while it was being prepared, he fell into a trance. And then he sees this vision of all these shellfish, you know, squid, shrimp, whatever is in there, reptiles, four-footed creatures, birds of the air, everything that Jews aren't supposed to eat, coming down in this sheet. And then a voice says, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." Peter says, "No, you know, I wouldn't ever disobey the law." And then the voice says, "What God has made clean, you must not call profane." And then he later comes to understand that this is that God is using food, a parable here about food, or a trance, a vision about food, to teach him that their new Christian community is to include Gentiles as well as Jews, and that table fellowship that Jesus started in his own ministry is now to continue in that Christian community and is to be a crossing of barriers between Jews and Gentiles. Was pretty revolutionary at that time. All right, well, that's a really quick trip here through the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, just kind of an overview. Before we go back then and look at chapter 5, I'd like to just open it up for discussion a little bit on this theme of food. And here, if any of it rings true for you in your lives, in your experience of the church, of Christian fellowship, or think about your own family, your own meals. Who do you eat with? What have been some really memorable meals for you and why, either positive or negative? What are meal rituals? And what do you think about the theme of food? Is Luke organizing the gospel around food, and what does that mean for us? Anybody have any memories of meals you want to share? Have you ever felt God's presence during a meal? Or absence? Yeah, I think meals can sometimes be times of great tension in our lives too, right? When you're trying to eat with someone that you're not getting along with, there's nothing worse than that. But meal memories that you want to share, stories?
For me, the eating alone is the worst thing in the world. If you go to a restaurant especially and see everyone else having fellowship and laughing and talking and sharing, and you sit there wishing you had a book to read or not knowing where to look, it just doesn't seem natural to eat alone.
Anybody else? Uh-huh.
Don't you think one of the reasons they may have come together to discuss these subjects at mealtime was, this is what happened with some of us, maybe all of us.
Can you talk a little louder, please?
Well, meal times are a time to pause, especially after you've eaten. And in the earlier days when people had harder chores and worked harder, I don't know if they worked harder, but anyway, it seems to me like it was one time where they could kind of pause and fellowship with one another, whereas when they're working, you don't have that opportunity. And so maybe this is why these subjects came up at meal times.
Uh-huh.
I don't know, it's just my speculation.
To expand on that theme, it's my impression that particularly in the time in which Jesus lived, that mealtime was not simply, you know, as we Americans in 1990 kind of sit down and eat real fast because we have to rush off and go somewhere, but it was a real social time where you spent long hours lingering around the table, and it was a time when it was very rude to just sort of dash off. You sat there and you shared a lot of things together, and probably still happens in Europe more than it does here, where the meal time is a lengthy time of sharing with friends and family. So I think that attack on Jesus oftentimes was just not only attack of the fact that he was eating with somebody, that he was actually socializing with these undesirable people.
Yeah, thanks. I think that is really important, that almost every meal had a sense of communion about it, that it was much more than just the food. In the Old Testament, for example, the way you sealed a covenant with another person or another nation was by having a meal together. So that eating was a real barrier crossing. I mean, it was a very significant symbolic event, like you talk about, much more than just the food. You had a hand, and then Bill.
I think feedback. Here we go again. I think the fact that nowadays children are allowed to come to the table and gulp something down and get up and leave, never even asking to be excused or anything. Now, when I was young, we weren't allowed to do that. We sat at the table until people were through. We didn't dash off to the basketball games. It was basketball games, but we did not.
Parents are not controlling their children. You can't blame the children. You have to blame the parents on that issue. Because you can't blame the children. It's the parents that allow that kind of thing.
Well, that's true. I agree with you there.
Okay, Bill?
I was thinking of the significance of a meal in kind of both ways, of you accepting them and them accepting you. A number of years ago when I was in graduate school in the South, and it was in the 60s, and there were freedom marches and things that were going on, and I was, in that particular case, I was at a graduate school where there were only 30 of us that were white, and there was not an inclusion of the people that we were with, predominantly black people, until one night on a weekend evening. My wife and I and my son had been invited up to Athens, Georgia, to have a meal with some of the people, and then everything changed. We had dinner and had music that was different than what I was used to, but we were included, and some of it was scary and most of it was exciting, but it all became very different. It was kind of like the meal was that focal point of us somewhat being accepted into the grouping, and until then we'd sat in classes, we'd talk, we'd done. But the meal was sort of there was something different after we'd eaten together.
Uh-huh. I think I'm on a similar track, but I can think of, I mean, I like to eat any time, but some of the really...
I'm like you and Luther.
the theme that is very present, especially in family and... times of celebration, it seems to me, for me, is a kind of scriptural one, that it's a time, whether it's a family meal or a funeral meal or a wedding meal, where there's caring, where there's space given to each one another, and perhaps more important, or certainly as important, in my experience, has been the time of scripture and prayer that attends those events many times, and that theme is, it's very easy for me to hear what you're saying about Luke's thing about eating. I don't know about the drinking part. I've often wondered what that meant. Does that mean German beer or?
Yeah, it does seem to have been alcoholic anyway. I mean, the glutton and drunkard to drink a lot of apple juice or something.
The other thought I had, when you first mentioned that he'd been crucified because of what he ate, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. And then the more I thought, no, that's probably absolutely true. Food is so basic. If you don't eat, you die. And the Old Testament is filled with laws about what you can eat, how you can eat it, when you can eat it, when you can't eat it. And I can see that for the Pharisees and the people who disapproved of Jesus, it was an easy, tangible thing to say, he's a sinner because he's not doing all those things that are listed in the Old Testament, as opposed to talking about maybe his preaching, which is maybe above the heads of most of the people at that time. Everyone could see that he was breaking the laws, because the laws were right there about the eating. And so I think it makes a great deal of sense, actually.
Well, let's... Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that is what Luke's doing, although I think then it becomes easy for us to sort of point the finger at those Pharisees and Jews, even in our day, who have ritual laws which we don't understand about food and that seem kind of ridiculous to us. But let's take it close to home, too. I mean, how hard it is to eat with people you don't know, and that whole barrier crossing thing, which is what Jesus did also in these meals, of eating with the most unlikely groups of people. And I think for most of us, we don't follow real strict dietary laws, but we certainly have the same, at least I do. I know I went into breakfast today and I sat down next to somebody I knew rather than at a table of people I didn't know. Now, why is that? I mean, why don't we reach out more often to cross barriers with people we don't know and those kinds of issues and follow Jesus in the way he ate with very unlikely dregs of society, those questions. You had your hand up, didn't you? And then,
well, you may have touched on it, but don't you think that when we're talking about gluttonous and eating habits, drinking or whatever, I think the matter was association more than... I don't want to get the impression that Jesus was gluttonous or had these bad habits. I think he was idyllic. You know, we should be like him, but he was associating with these people who didn't have good habits, the lower class people, and this was their custom and their way of living, and he simply associated with them, but I don't think he had their habits, is what I'm trying to say.
Don't you? Why not?
Jesus is God, and he's trying to teach us good ways, not bad ways, and I look at him as being the leader to lead us to the best ways of life, and gluttonous isn't good, and neither is excessive drinking. He preaches that, Paul preaches drinking and eating in excess. But no, I think his problem was not problem, but he was accused simply because he was associating with people who didn't have the manners like the wealthy or the Pharisees or whoever. He just wanted to meet. Talk to these people and teach them.
Well, I'll speak as a glutton. I know I.
So am I.
Have you ever noticed how the more expensive the restaurant you go to, the smaller the portions are? Yeah, like you say, I mean, the wealthy people eat these stinky little portions and charge $35. Okay, go ahead. Let's just take a couple more. You had your hand up and then you here.
I was just going to comment that the young lady this morning who did the matins really got my Achilles heel when she spoke about going through the grocery store line and judging people on the basis of what's in their cart. That's all. The fact that she really revealed to me a very judgmental streak in me that I tend to nurture and not see in myself.
Well, in response to that, I
I can do with that too. In response to your statement,
yes, I agree with her about that. Yeah, because in our church, the deaf often are required to go and associate with a lot of other people that we might not know, and the pastor encourages us to associate with other people. That helps.
In response to Jesus, what he was teaching with people, whether he was teaching them to eat the correct proportions or whatever, it seems to me that what he was saying, possibly, is don't get so caught up in the laws and the rules of how much to eat or what to eat or whatever, but care for one another, be with one another. If that means, if you're a vegetarian and you go to somebody and they put meat in front of you, maybe that means you have to eat it for one day or vice versa. But don't worry so much about what you're taking in, but how you relate to one another, because I've created you for one another.
And I think it relates to our sermon.
Go ahead. Yeah, to help others, that's an important thing. Uh-huh. I think, and not always think of ourselves. Uh-huh.
In our pure lives. I think it relates to John's sermon last night too, that we sort of, quote, good Christians are uncomfortable sometimes with the lavishness in a lot of different ways that we see in the Gospels. You know, that we don't want to have as much fun as sinners do, and so we're not going to permit ourselves, you know, or we're not going to take the risk of really being lavishly Christian, really following what the gospel shows. But it is a sort of, in some ways, almost, well, I don't know, we'll have to talk about it if it's excess or not. You know, you say it isn't, I don't know what to think, but certainly it's a lavishness of food sharing in the gospel of Luke that that often makes us nervous, a lavishness of party spirit, you know, that Jesus just loved to go to banquets and talk about banquets, and that there's sort of a joyous kind of sharing that we see in the Gospels. You know, just think of the feeding of the 5,000 and the spirit that must have been there too, that Jesus tries to communicate in communicating God's lavishness with the world, like the billion in John's parable last night. I mean, that there really is that kind of spirit of abundance in many aspects of life in the gospel that tends to make us nervous in a lot of ways. Well, let's look at the call of Levi, and I think we'll see some of that right here in this banquet, which certainly was lavish, in Luke 5.
Where are we looking at?
Luke 5, 27, let's go all the way through 39. It's kind of a long section, but it's all about eating and drinking and new wine and old wineskins, which is what John was talking about last week. Does someone want to volunteer? Someone read slowly and loudly, and we can all follow along.
I will.
Okay.
After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything and rose and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his house. And there was a large company of tax collectors and others sitting at table with them. And the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." And they said to him, "The disciples of John fast often and offer prayers, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink." And Jesus said to them, "Can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days." He told them a parable also. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it upon an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and it will be spilled, and the skins will be destroyed. but new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. And no one, after drinking old wine, desires new, for he says the old is good.
So he at least seems to have known a little bit about wine. Okay, just a little bit about the story, the call of Levi. The story immediately preceding that has been the healing of the paralytic. There in 5:18, you see that just then some of the men came carrying a paralyzed man. Okay, and Jesus heals this guy by saying in verse 20, your sins are forgiven. And this causes great scandal. You know, it's a question already of who has the power to forgive sins, and why are you healing him, not by saying be healed, but by forgiving his sins. So we've already been set up here with a discussion about forgiveness of sins to then take us right into this call of Levi, who was certainly a great sinner in the eyes of most Jewish people in Galilee at that time. Another book I ordered for the bookstore is this one, My Enemy is My Guest, by Josephine Massingberry Ford. And her subtitle is Jesus and Violence in Luke. And it's a book about the whole theme of love of enemies as the basic theme in Luke. Karis thinks that food is one of the main reasons Jesus got himself crucified, and she'll say that it's his love for his enemies. And again, this boundary crossing idea. And she has a chapter in here on the role of tax collectors in the Gospel of Luke, which I found very helpful. And basically, they were the absolutely most despised people in the society at that time. It would be as if, she's got one quote here, it was basically like, here it is, Jesus' fellowship with toll collectors, she's saying that it's probably toll collectors rather than tax collectors, could be interpreted as fellowship with virtual traitors. That these were the worst people in society to associate with. They were the ones who were carrying out the Roman government's tax collection within the community. People paid their taxes with a coin that had the head of a Roman goddess on it, and so it was idolatry to have a different god. It was a tax farming kind of system where these guys could add on as much extra as they wanted, as much as they could extract from people. And in every way, they were the worst possible sinners in society. I was trying to think of what the worst modern day analogy would be, you know, because, well, I don't have any friends who work for the IRS, but I wouldn't think of them as bad people, I don't think. I mean, most of us sort of agree that those people are doing jobs that perhaps are necessary in society. Maybe they collect too much, but that's not their fault. You know, so it's not that idea of that person is a horrible sinner. Maybe like a crack dealer, okay? Levi, would that be a good example? A crack house operator or something like that? I mean, think of Levi as the worst possible person in your community. And Jesus goes to that individual, knocks at their door and says, follow me. And then that person, the crack house dealer, who has a lot of money, which has been gotten unjustly, just like the tax collectors in Jesus' day, throws a huge party, invites all his crack house dealer buddies from the other crack houses in town, and Jesus then eats with them. Is that an effective modern day?
Impressive.
So what do you think? We could make it even more scandalous. It's very similar to the call of Elisha in the Old Testament. Why don't you hold your finger here and look at Elijah's call of Elisha in 1 Kings 19. Well, it's kind of a weird story with a lot of names in it, so why don't I just read it in 1 Kings 19:19. So this is when Elijah is going to call Elisha to be his successor, you know.
Two different spellings.
Yeah, Elijah is with a J, and Elisha is with SH. It's like Elijah Jr. Okay, so this is a call story too. This is a follow me story. And scholars think that the story, the call of Levi in Luke 5 is definitely structured to be parallel to this one. So it's not only a crack house dealer, you know, who's being called, but it's a crack house dealer who's being called like one of the Old Testament prophets. So it's scandalous here. Okay, so he, that's Elijah, set out from there and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. What do you want to do? Why don't I skip over all the names? Who was plowing. There were 12 yoke of oxen ahead of him, and he was with the 12th. Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle over him. So he throws his cape over him, and that's how he calls him. Okay, so Elisha left the oxen, ran after Elijah, and said, "Let me kiss my mother and my father, and then I will follow you." Then Elijah says this kind of weird line to him. We don't know what it means. It has textual problems too. "Go back again, for what have I done to you?" He returned from following him, took the yoke of oxen, and slaughtered them. Using the equipment from the oxen, he boiled their flesh and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out and followed Elijah and became his servant. So what's the similarity to the call of Levi here, if any? Do you agree there is a similarity? There's differences too, certainly.
Elisha is having a feast sort of to say goodbye to his people. And you could say that Levi is doing a lot of the same thing, saying goodbye to people.
Yeah. If there is a similarity between these two stories, it's this banquet idea that both of them take time. Actually, this is the Old Testament lesson that sometimes is read in contrast, you know, to the gospel where Jesus says, where he criticizes the people who make all these excuses, "Lord, I will follow you, but first let me go kiss my mother and father goodbye," you know. So that it's sometimes picked up on that whole element. But anyway, in this instance, he is given time to say goodbye to his relatives. That's not condemned here. And to have this great feast to say goodbye to everybody else. He takes his livelihood, his oxen, kills them, and has this huge party before he goes off and follows Elijah.
Was Elijah comparable to, in the eyes of his countrymen, to the Levite?
No.
So there's not that similarity.
Well, unless you want to think that Luke is trying to tell us that Levi wasn't nearly as evil, that tax collectors were not as evil as everybody thought, or they shouldn't have been thought of that way. No, Elisha would have just been a nice farmer. But what do you think about that parallel? Is what then would it be saying about Levi? Or do you think there's something else?
Well, Jesus is also saying something about himself, because Israel was looking for a prophet like Elijah, and here is Christ doing an Elijah-like thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess I get more out of that with Jesus modeling himself as, yes, I am this person who is to follow Elijah, more than I get it out of the two people that did the following.
Okay, that's a really good point. Yeah, certainly all the gospel writers are trying to portray Jesus as the new Elijah. So yeah, it's the one who calls rather than the one who has the banquet that you think is a parallel there. It's just a theory that there even is a parallel there. I mean, you don't have to buy into any of that, but thanks for that. Anybody else? Any comments on this?
Maybe you're going to get into this, but you know, the thing that bothers me about our judgment of the tax collector or the crack house dealer bothers me is that what parts of my life are open to just as much judgment. Cindy said it earlier that struck me, that there are the overt things that some people do that perhaps in society are easier to judge, and they're more tangible, she put them. It's very tangible to say a crack dealer is a meaning of a very worthless man. But what about the slumlord? what about my addictions? Or what about my excesses? What about my purchase of goods that I know are produced by a slave market? Are those any less worthy of judgment than, you know, I like that word tangible. I can, it's easy for me to judge tangible acts, but boy, there's a lot of subtleties in the way I conduct my life that could give cause to have a lot of judgment. Tax collector.
Mm-hmm. One thing that Massey-Berry Ford here has is her theory. She goes through how prevalent the tax collectors are in Luke. If you look back to Luke 3, for example, Luke is the only one that has, everybody has John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness, but Luke is the only one that has this little section here in verses 10 through 14, where it's different groups of people asking John, well, then what should we do? You know, because he comes, you know, fire, brimstone, this quote from Isaiah, and people are convicted by that, and then they say, well, what should we do? And one of them is in verse 12, even tax collectors came to be baptized, and they asked him, teacher, what should we do? And he said to them, collect no more than the amount prescribed for you. One of her theories is that in Luke's community, you know, the Gospels were written down sort of after it all happened, by the early Christian community as they reflected and remembered Jesus' sayings and his deeds. One of the theories that she has is that in Luke's community, there were a number of reformed tax collectors who were not being accepted by the other Christians, the other good people in that town or in that community. And so that Luke then puts in a number of stories about Jesus' dealings with tax collectors, in this case, John the Baptist's dealings with tax collectors, to say to people, receive these people in your community, and that it was still maybe a problem that was a live one in that community, and this idea that there were the sort of good Christians then in Luke's community who did not want to associate still to that day with these people. And we need to think about that in our own communities, in our own lives, of who is it that we don't seem to want to associate with.
And really, it's not the tax collecting that seems to be the sin here. It's the taking the extra stuff under the table, the, you know, adding on and keeping for themselves, the greed, that's really the sin, and not the fact that this is their profession and they're tax collectors. They're making a living doing that, but it's the greed of taking extra, impressing people by their greed.
Although actually that was the only way they made a living, because they were not paid. What they could manage to collect extra was their pay. And what he's telling them there is do it for free, actually.
Or maybe add on a just amount, but not too much. Yeah, it's hard to know what he's saying here.
Well, uh-huh. This could have been any person, really. I think the point that stands out to me, he passed this person. And I'm sure Jesus knew what his response would be, and he invited him to follow him, and the person got up and followed him, whatever it might have been.
And left
and so
everything.
Then Jesus went into his teaching. This was one of his followers then, and he was teaching them what Jesus had to teach, who he was, who Jesus was, and what he expected his disciples to do here on earth, is to teach the new gospel.
Mm-hmm.
But this could have been, you know, it's telling us there is no person too bad to follow Jesus. You know, whatever you want to might concoct in your mind, the worst person you can dream of, if the person responds to Jesus' call, it's fine. He's saved.
Mm-hmm. How did you want to say?
I was thinking, I can't get Marcus Borg out of my head. Uh-huh. He would say that, for instance, the issue, the fault of the tax collector was not that he was greedy, but that he was exiled from the people of Abraham because he was assisting the Roman conqueror, and that he was one of many people who were exiled from really being a part of the people. And what Jesus was doing was fighting a whole notion of how you are God's people by being holy, that being God's people depends upon your holiness. And the Pharisees worked very hard at that, and others, the Essenes, went off into the wilderness because they didn't see any place to be holy there. And the rebels went into the hills to fight the Romans because the only way to be holy was to throw the Romans out. And Jesus proposes a different way of seeing God as the one who is compassionate and who gathers this scattered, broken, divided community back together again. And the meal was one of the places where that compassion and acceptance was demonstrated. So that it wasn't quite so much, we tend to think very much in terms of individuals and maybe in terms of personal salvation. Borg suggests that a lot of what's going on is social transformation, and that of course has an impact on individuals, but that it was the change of how that whole society was structured as being part of what Jesus was trying to do here.
Thanks. Let's just look for a couple minutes to follow up on that at the other story here in Luke 19, the kind of the other side of the bracket, the call of Zacchaeus. That would go right here, because I think this is really significant to pick up on some of those themes that you were talking about. This is sort of the worst tax collector. You know, we start with Levi, who's a pretty bad tax collector, but then we've got Zacchaeus, who's the leader, and he's extracted the most unjustly. You know, he's absolutely the worst possible one. And see what Jesus' response is to him. In verse 5, when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." So he hurried down and was happy to welcome him. All who saw it began to grumble, typical, always, and said, "He has gone to be the guest of one who is a sinner." Zacchaeus stood there and said to the Lord, "Look, half of my possessions I will give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times as much." And then Jesus says, and this is really an important line to pick up what you said, because this is powerful stuff. Jesus says, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham." So yeah, it's this idea of taking those who had been exiled by the community, and the community thinks, you know, these people are too horrible, they've gone beyond the bounds of what is acceptable, they're outside the pale. And Jesus says, this too is a son of Abraham. There's only one other person of whom Jesus uses this kind of language in the Gospel of Luke, and that's the woman who has been bent over her whole life in Luke 13. An outcast. She's been bent over her whole life. Jesus straightens her up on the Sabbath, and then when everybody gets so mad about that and says, you know, how could you do a healing on the Sabbath? You know, this is really terrible. Then Jesus says, "For she too is a daughter of Abraham." So that's a really powerful way of including people in the plan of salvation and saying, now look, you think this person is outside the plan of salvation, that I shouldn't have been doing this, you know, I shouldn't heal people on the Sabbath, I shouldn't eat with great sinners, tax collectors. This too is a daughter of Abraham, a son of Abraham. And today, salvation has come to this house. It's the only time he says anything like that. I mean, it's really powerful. And then the very next chapter starts the entry into Jerusalem and Jesus' passion. So this is a key scene here, the way Luke brackets the gospel with these two meals. We're not going to have time to look at the Pharisee meals, but I would invite you to look at those on your own. I mean, it's really important. Jesus can move back and forth in the gospel between, you know, here he's eating one day at the crack dealer's house, and the next day he goes to the White House, you know, basically to eat with the Pharisees. Three times he eats with the leaders of his day too. He seems to have very crossing boundaries all the time. He seems to love to go to people's house to eat, and so he does three times. with Pharisees as well. Okay, tomorrow we'll look at the Christmas story a little bit, some lifestyle and liberation themes in that, and then Friday we'll look at meals where Jesus is the host, the feeding of the 5,000, and then especially the Last Supper.